Hello. First, I want to say that I am so pleased and honored to be invited to address the group at the Perimeter Institute, especially on this subject, the Perimeter being a place where so many fascinating and correct and non-trivial contributions have been made to the subject of gravity and quantum information theory. Lots of real progress that's definitely happened. And I want to say, I missed lunch, but don't mind the banana. It's just potassium is good for stressful situations. Not that there's anything stressful about addressing such a brilliant group. It's really only stressful giving talks when people will say wrong things from the audience or ask questions with some sort of agenda. That's stressful. But I probably won't need this because so many good people here who surely will understand what I'm going to say. So, quantum information theory. That's what we're going to talk about today. It's interesting. Really, really interesting. Isn't it? I mean, come on. It just is. Because it's all about general properties of Hilbert spaces and tensor factorizations, which means it all just reduces to linear algebra, which we all know is fun and exciting, which means that quantum information theory, logically, must be fun and exciting too. After all, that's physics, right? Physics is just linear algebra, and computer programmers can walk around lecturing us about how they understand it just as well or better than we do, right? Surely that's true. Surely there's nothing non-trivial about quantum information theory, something that computer programmers wouldn't understand or know about already. Would there be? Come on, you have to admit it. Okay, well, fine, maybe it isn't that interesting. Mostly it isn't, granted, but okay, here we are. This is a talk about quantum information theory, and that's it. We have an hour and a half or 2 hours or whatever together, and we might as well find something interesting to say about it. And what could be more interesting than something counterintuitive about entanglement? Something iconoclastic and shocking that will scandalize and horrify you. Well, how about this? Entanglement doesn't exist. It is not a thing. It is, to choose the politest word possible, nonsense. I edited the words. I forgot to change the figures. Anyway. Well, I don't want to shock and scandalize you too much, so let me qualify that statement just a little bit. I don't want to say that entanglement is always nonsense, just that it is usually nonsense. Or to say what I'm going to tell you a bit more quantitatively, entanglement is generically nonsense. So what I'm going to tell you today is that there is a particular obstruction in local quantum field theory that renders the usual notion of entanglement between spatial regions intrinsically ill-defined in a sense that's both formally precise and physically meaningful, physically consequential.
So that obstruction sometimes vanishes, but in even dimensions, it is generically non-vanishing, and that obstruction is given by the familiar gravitational anomaly. So we are going to show the following. The existence of certain kinds of anomalies, particular, we'll focus on the gravitational anomaly in two dimensions, but there are other other versions of this, implies that there is no meaningful definition of entanglement respecting a locality, and that this is not just some artifact having to do with short distance or regulators. It's really a long distance property in continuum field theory. So let me emphasize, when I say there's no such thing as entanglement in the theory, I don't mean that entanglement in some sense vanishes between spatial regions. I mean that the mathematical concept of entanglement between regions of space is ill-defined in theories with certain gravitational anomalies and doesn't really admit any sort of reasonable reconstruction of the definition, any sort of reasonable refinement of the definition that respects our notions of locality at long distances. So I'm going to focus on two dimensions, but similar statements can be derived for higher even dimensional field theories, and maybe some odd dimensions too, I'm not sure. So I also want to emphasize that nobody is questioning the basic concepts of linear algebra here. This will not be one of those crackpot talks. I'm sorry to disappoint you. Of course, in any separable Hilbert space, you can always write a basis and tensor factorize that basis into factors. Okay? I'm only telling you that those tensor factors cannot be thought of as respecting locality. They can't be thought of as representing Hilbert spaces living in complementary regions of a spatial slice. That is, if the spatial slice is the union of two complementary pieces, two non-overlapping pieces, then we do not have a tensor factorization of the full Hilbert space of the form H sub A tensor H sub B. Right, so now some of you may be saying, well, that's old hat. We know that things like that happen in gauge theory. But I want to emphasize that the obstruction to entanglement I'm going to discuss is not related to the obstruction to factorization occurring in gauge theories, having to do with the fact that matter lives on vertices and gauge fields live on links or whatever. There is some issue about that, but that's really a short distance artifact and does not have to do with what I'll be talking about today. Right, so that obstruction the obstruction we're going to be talking about today is an infrared obstruction to entanglement that has nothing to do with how the theory is regularized and renormalized, nothing to do with how the entangling surface is defined. Yeah.
So the gauge field anomaly you're talking about can be renormalized away.
Yeah, it can. Sure. So when I say that entanglement and tensor factorizations don't exist, I really mean it in that sense, with all those qualifications. Okay, so I'm going to show you the existence of a non-vanishing gravitational anomaly means that the Hilbert space does not tensor factorize, even sufficiently generalized with extra degrees of freedom at the entangling surface or what have you. But it will be easier to understand in terms of the logically equivalent contrapositive, which is to say if the Hilbert space tensor factorizes even in this generalized sense, then there exists no notion of the gravitational anomaly. Then the gravitational anomaly vanishes. So it's this latter form that's related to more familiar concepts and easier to prove directly. Now, you've all been remarkably restrained up to this point. Most of you should be jumping out of your seats by now and shouting at me that my ideas are wrong and I'm stupid and I don't know what I'm talking about, blah, 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 blah. Actually, I forgot I was giving this talk in Canada. I forgot to rewrite this slide. People are polite here. But I'm sure many of you are thinking that. In particular, you should be wanting to tell me, Rob or someone, should be taking the bait here, that of course the Hilbert space tensor factorizes, because you can always see that by putting the system on a spatial lattice, where tensor factorization is manifest. And of course, any system can be put on a spatial lattice, can't it? I mean, we all know that from the quantum field theory textbook we obviously didn't bother to read, because... What?
I read your abstract.
Fine. Well, nonetheless, for people who didn't do the reading, let's examine this idea a little more closely. We will see that when the gravitational anomaly is non-vanishing, then a lattice regulator never exists. So this is a kind of corollary of our general proof. So in free field theory, the connection between the anomaly and the existence or non-existence of lattice regulators is an old story going back to the early days of lattice gauge theory in the 1980s. So 35 years ago, Nielsen and Ninomiya proved various no-go theorems for chiral fermions on the lattice, and the two-dimensional version is the simplest of all. So let me review the old-fashioned proof of the old-fashioned, sort of very restricted Nielsen-Ninomiya theorem, and then I'm going to prove a much, much broader version of it. But so the old-fashioned version only applies to free fermions. So suppose, or you know, weakly coupled fermions. Suppose we have a system of fermions on the lattice satisfying canonical commutation relations. So the little indices of the lattice site, the big indices are the internal label, a species of fermions of some sort. And consider the most general free Hamiltonian satisfying a bounded nearest neighbor property, which is to say a Hamiltonian that is quadratic in fermions and links fermions that are a bounded number of lattice sites apart. So here the real and imaginary parts are appropriately symmetrized and anti-symmetrized. And so we've chosen this coupling to satisfy bounded nearest neighbor property. So this vanishes when I minus j is greater than some fixed number. Okay. So that's the most stringent criterion of locality of a Hamiltonian you can have in a lattice system, but you could make it broader. You could make the coupling fall off exponentially with distance or something, just as long as it doesn't fall off too slowly, as long as it doesn't fall off like a power law, which is really non-local. Like the long-range easing model, for instance, would have a power law fall off, but we don't want to consider theories like that. They generally don't have a stress tensor, and they aren't local or causal or anything like that. So now if we Fourier transform the fields, then the Hamiltonian is diagonal in Fourier modes. So this kernel MAB is Hermitian and depends polynomially on this exponential of the Fourier momentum. And the Fourier momentum is periodically identified. So the Fourier momenta, since we're living on a lattice, take values in a circle rather than a real line. So these are called the block waves or quasi-momenta, I don't know, various words for the same thing, but it all means that alpha is a circle-valued variable rather than real-valued. So for any value of alpha, the frequency spectrum of the fermions is given by the set of eigenvalues of the matrix M, and to the modes that survive in the infrared are those in neighborhoods of alpha space where one of the eigenvalues, one of the eigenfrequencies, has a zero. That's what infrared means. So the velocity of each mode in the infrared is just the derivative with respect to alpha. And since the eigenvalues are just real periodic functions of the momentum alpha, each eigenvalue that crosses zero from negative to positive must later cross zero from positive to negative. So therefore, there are always exactly as many left-moving as right-moving massless fermion modes. So this is the essence of the old-fashioned 1980s proof of the two-dimensional version of the Nielsen-Ninomiya theorem. Okay, so it's impossible to get a relativistic fermion theory in the infrared with C left different from C right. Questions on that? This is sort of review. So this is the standard proof of the Nielsen-Ninomiya theorem, or just a kind of summary of it. Now, this proof only applies to free fermion theories or weakly coupled fermion theories, and even for those theories, it's a bit technical. So in particular, you have to Fourier transform, and once you go to Fourier space, you kind of lose any nice picture in real space. So there are, you know, things about this proof which aren't ideal. But so now I'm going to give you a new proof of a vastly generalized version of the theorem with a very different character that uses the arena of real space rather than Fourier space, and it applies to all interacting theories. So the proof is simpler, more intuitive, and on the other side, it's much broader. It covers much, much more territory. So the structure of the proof is as follows. So consider an arbitrary CFT in two dimensions, and suppose it has a lattice regulator with bounded nearest neighbor property, or exponentially falling off coupling, or whatever, anything like that. So from a lattice regulator for the CFT, but not necessarily Gaussian interactions. So we're assuming a local lattice Hamiltonian, but not a Gaussian one. From any kind of lattice regulator, we can construct a boundary condition for the CFT. The boundary condition is just known as free boundary conditions, free boundary conditions. So the Hamiltonian in the bulk of the space flows to the original conformal Hamiltonian, because the interactions are nearest neighbor. But the boundary condition, well, it may or may not be conformal, but on sufficiently long distances, it should flow to a conformal boundary condition. And the conformal boundary condition we'll derive is unitary and energy conserving by construction. But it's easy to show that conformal field theories can only admit such consistent boundary conditions when they have equal left and right moving central charges. So the structure of the proof is going to be, if a local lattice regulator exists, then a boundary condition exists, and that will imply C left is equal to C right. So for a free massless fermion theory, the central charges, by the way, are just one half the number of Majorana Weyl fermions of a given chirality. So our proof is going to imply the usual Nielsen-Nemea theorem in two dimensions as an immediate consequence. Okay, but our proof is more general and more interesting because it applies to any interacting conformal field theory in two dimensions. So schematically, the structure of the proof is this. Existence of a lattice regulator implies the existence of a unitary energy-preserving boundary condition, which implies vanishing of the gravitational anomaly. So that's what I just said. Okay, so let's talk about the individual steps defining these implications. And none of the steps is that non-trivial. So first, why does the existence of a lattice regulator for a CFT imply the existence of a boundary condition for the CFT? So construction is very simple. You start with the lattice Hamiltonian and simply delete all degrees of freedom at negative lattice sites. That's it. Delete all degrees of freedom to the left of the origin, and you are left with the same lattice Hamiltonian density you started with, but it only exists on the right side of the real line. Yeah, Matthias.
Very good question, but here, do you have in mind like quantum Hamiltonian 1 plus 1 or Euclidean Hamiltonian 2?
Yeah, let's talk about Hamiltonian lattice regulators, but of course, I mean, you can always Wick rotate. Yeah. Wick rotation isn't really an issue. Right. But I think I know what you're asking, actually. You mean if you start by discretizing Euclidean time and space, does the proof still apply? And the answer is yes, of course, because you can make the temporal spacing as fine as you want. Right. So that distinction isn't so important here. So you might as well think about Hamiltonian lattice systems. But the unitarity properties are much clearer in Lorentzian signature. So I'm going to talk about it in those terms. So we've assumed that the lattice regulator had the bounded nearest neighbor property. So the lattice Hamiltonian is unaffected by the deletions after some number of lattice spacings right of the boundary. So it follows that the bulk Hamiltonian density flows at long distance to the same bulk Hamiltonian density as in the CFT on the full real line. And only the boundary Hamiltonian is unknown. Second, why does this necessarily give a conformal as opposed to non-conformal boundary condition? So this is a bit subtler. So certainly one doesn't start out with a conformal boundary condition. There's nothing about the procedure I described that gives you conformal invariance. And of course, there's no guarantee that the boundary condition becomes conformal by the scale lambda at which the bulk Hamiltonian becomes conformal. So the bulk Hamiltonian flows ultimately to something by the Zamolodikoff C theorem, but the boundary Hamiltonian we don't know. So at the scale lambda, where the bulk Hamiltonian becomes conformal, the boundary Hamiltonian may still contain non-conformal operators with large coefficients and units of lambda. But intuitively, there are only a couple of possibilities. If the non-conformal operators in the boundary Hamiltonian are irrelevant, we expect that they'll flow to zero at sufficiently long distances, and the boundary Hamiltonian will flow to a conformal boundary condition. If, on the other hand, there are relevant operators in the boundary Hamiltonian, we expect them to give large frequencies to some boundary degrees of freedom, which can then be integrated out, leaving us with a boundary condition with fewer degrees of freedom, and then start the argument again. So eventually, one expects, the process should terminate when we reach a fixed point, or at the latest, when there are no boundary degrees of freedom left, and we should get a conformal boundary condition. So to make this intuition more precise, there's actually a functional on boundary theories in the two-dimensional CFT, known as the Affleck-Ludwig G functional, which is proven to be monotonic along RG flows and stationary if and only if the RG flow is at a fixed point. So this almost proves the existence of a conformal boundary condition with one caveat. It's analogous to the Zamolodikov C function with just one exception. So the G functional is only conjectured to be bounded below always, in contrast with the C function, which is definitely bounded below if the theory is unitary. Okay, so that's the only real conceptual difference between the two functionals. Though I should say that the G functional is proven to be bounded below in various different particular bulk conformal Hamiltonians. It's only a question of, is it known to be bounded below for any possible bulk Hamiltonian? And that's not known at present. But it's believed to be true. There are no known counterexamples, and for instance, Friedan and Konechny have provided a great deal of numerical evidence, also together with Schmidt-Colline more recently. So under this Friedan-Konechny hypothesis, the G-functional must eventually stop decreasing, and then every boundary theory must eventually flow to a conformal boundary condition. So from here on, we'll just assume that the Friedan-Konechny hypothesis is true. The logic of our derivations depends on it implicitly, or explicitly, really. So finally, why does the existence of a conformal boundary condition necessarily imply the vanishing of the gravitational anomaly? So this question has a simple answer. It just follows from unitarity and energy conservation in the presence of the boundary. So the necessity of C left minus C right for a consistent boundary condition can be proven several different ways. The most straightforward is in Cardy's boundary state formalism. So here's what a boundary state is. A boundary state is a state of the CFT on a circle in two dimensions. Such that the thermal path integral on the half line, or the interval, can be represented as overlaps in boundary states in the cross channel. So consider a CFT on an interval of length L, and to take the thermal partition function at inverse temperature beta, this can be represented in the cross channel as the partition function on the Euclidean cylinder with circumference beta and length L. So exchanging the roles of space and Euclidean time, we reinterpret the same partition function as the matrix element of a Euclidean time propagation through time L of an initial and final state on the circle of radius beta over 2 pi rather than an interval. So the initial and final states are called boundary states because they started out before changing the channel as spatial boundaries. So a boundary state always lives in the Hilbert space of states on the circle, not the interval. So I say more or less, because the boundary state is not quite normalizable, but it's normalizable when acted on with any arbitrarily small Euclidean time propagation. So it's liminally in the normalizable Hilbert space. So questions so far on what a boundary state is and so forth. Okay. So in the presence of a boundary, causality, energy conservation, and conformal invariance imply T equals T tilde at the boundary. So the two chiral stress tensors are simply equal. And at finite temperature, we can Fourier transform along the thermal circle and then exchange the roles of Euclidean time and space. So this translates in the circle channel, in the cross channel, to a condition known as the Cardy condition, that the left moving Virasoro generator with energy n minus the right moving Virasoro generator with energy negative n annihilates the state for all integers n, positive n, negative. Okay, so this is just one of the defining conditions of a boundary state. It's not the only one, but it's one. But given this condition, it's straightforward to show that C left minus C right has to vanish if there's any boundary state at all. There exists no consistent unitary energy-conserving boundary condition if the left and right moving central charges are unequal. And there are other sort of more physical ways to see this. The best Lorentzian time way to see it is that the central charges measure the asymptotic density of states, left-moving and right-moving states with a given energy. So if you throw a left-moving state at a boundary, and the theory is unitary and energy-conserving, you will get back a right-moving state with the same energy. But of course, energy conservation and unitarity don't allow that if the numbers of states are not approximately equal, right? Otherwise, there is no unitary map describing scattering off a boundary. Okay, so there are many simple, easy ways to understand this non-existence of boundary conditions in gravitationally anomalous theories. Okay, so there's just no such thing as a boundary condition with unequal central charges. It's easiest to see with C right equals zero. Right, so there are many ways to show it. Any meromorphic function on the cylinder that vanishes identically on the boundary must vanish identically. So the two-point function of left-moving stress tensor must vanish. Therefore, C left must vanish as well. There are many, many ways to see this. And there are various caveats. So for instance, the boundary entropy must be finite. So all of the counterexamples that some of you people probably have in mind violate that condition, for instance. Okay, so we've shown that if there's a conformal boundary condition of any kind, then C left must equal C right. So together with the Ferdinand-Konecny hypothesis and the construction of boundary conditions from lattice regulators, we've shown that the existence of a lattice regulator implies the existence of a boundary which implies C left equals C right. So we've proven the generalized Nielsen-Nenemia theorem. And this result, we think, is powerful in its own right, but it is closely related to quantum information theoretic ideas. So really, people sometimes find the Nielsen-Nenemia theorem sort of hard to understand, but I think it's easier to understand if you don't think of it as something having to do with complicated things you're trying to do with the dynamics of the fermions. The Nielsen-Nenemia theorem doesn't have anything to do with dynamics. It doesn't have anything to do with the way you tell the fermions to evolve in time. The Nielsen-Nenemia theorem is really a kinematical information theoretic constraint that has to do with the impossibility of even localizing the state of a system, a fermion system or any other sort of system, of even localizing the information in such a system to localized sites if the gravitational anomaly is non-vanishing. The Nielsen-Nenemia theorem is really a clue, a hint, that the gravitational anomaly is really a fundamental obstruction to the localization of information at the quantum level. Okay, so as we observed earlier, the tensor factorization of the Hilbert space is manifest if a lattice regulator exists. So we have a set of logical implications that looks like this. Lattice regulator implies existence of a boundary condition, implies vanishing of the gravitational anomaly, but lattice regulator also implies the existence of a tensor factorization. Modulo short distance details, which I assure you are not relevant to these considerations. And please, if people have questions about that at the end or in the middle, please feel free to ask. But
sorry, this may be a stupid question.
but is it possible for the boundary state you constructed simply zero?
Oh, sure, but a boundary state being zero means that there's no boundary condition.
So how can a boundary state be zero when the annulus partition function would be zero?
Right.
And it's a trace.
Right.
Positive.
There's no such thing. I mean, a boundary condition, a boundary state being zero just means there's no boundary at all.
No.
I don't.
It's worse.
It's worse.
No.
It becomes trivial.
No, it's not a question of trivial. It does not mean trivial. It means if you take the partition function, I mean, what David is saying is correct.
The boundary condition vanishes, right? So.
Right. There's no boundary. It's not a boundary condition. It's just zero as a partition function. It's not a partition function of a system with boundary. But maybe I'm misunderstanding. What's the issue?
No, I'm not sure. So, well
it's a, you're not sure what your question is, or you're not sure what the answer is.
You wrote down that the element is CR multiplying.
Yes.
Multiplying the boundary state is zero.
That's right.
But it just implies either CL is equal to CR or the state vanishes.
Right. But the state can't vanish if there is a boundary condition. If there is a boundary condition, then the Hilbert space on the interval is non-empty. That's what a boundary condition means. If the Hilbert space is non-empty, then the partition function over the Hilbert space on the interval is not zero.
Also, the disk, just the disk is the tensor, what's the coefficient from the vacuum?
Yes, that's right. That's right. Right. Zero. I mean, you can take it as a definition if you like, but zero is not a boundary. I mean, if you want to say that zero is not a boundary state, you can say it that way. But a boundary condition gives you a non-zero boundary state is another thing that you can say. So if a boundary condition exists, then there exists a boundary state which is not zero, and therefore C left is equal to C right. I mean, okay. Okay, so we would like to fit these conditions together into a single sequence of logical implications. Okay, so we'd like to see if we can derive the existence of a boundary condition from the existence of a tensor factorization, even without assuming the existence of a lattice regulator. So, of course, this would give you this, which would then give you this and this. Or rather, this would give you this, and this also gives you this and this, but we would like to directly show, without assuming this, that this gives you this and this. Okay. So we would like to construct from any definition of a tensor factorization respecting locality, we would like to find a general recipe for constructing a boundary condition. And we have such a recipe, it's not hard either. So we'd like to do this without necessarily assuming a lattice regulator exists. And so we're going to establish this middle link. And we want to even be, we want to avoid assuming anything which is almost tantamount to the existence of a lattice regulator. We want to really avoid that. So the basic idea is as follows. If the Hilbert space tensor factorizes, even approximately modulo short distance stuff, that tensor product symbol should be always understood as a generalized tensor product in that sense, then there are two independent Hilbert spaces on which one can try to write individual Hamiltonians. And if each individual Hamiltonian is locally the same in each region as the Hamiltonian on the full spatial slice, then each Hamiltonian represents a CFT with boundary in the standard sense. So in other words, if you can write Hamiltonians on bounded spatial regions, which implement operator equations of motion which are the same as those in the full space, then one has a Hamiltonian with boundary in the standard sense. And by the way, I know many of you think that you are thinking of counterexamples. Please do not hesitate, out of Canadian politeness or whatever other reservations, to aggressively tell me about the counterexamples you have in mind, because nothing I haven't heard before. And be happy to discuss whatever you think the counterexample is. Anyway, all we have to do is establish that we can, in fact, choose a Hamiltonian on each factor that is locally the same as the original Hamiltonian. So the existence of such Hamiltonians is almost automatic if a tensor factorization exists. It is basically automatic. So remember what it means to have a tensor factorization. So for any operators, respectively, we have embeddings of the factor operator algebras into the full operator algebra of that kind. And then for finite dimensional vector spaces, we also have predictions that go the other way, given by taking the trace on one side. Right. So for finite dimensional vector spaces, we have these projections that just reverse the embedding into the tensor product. And those reverse maps are just given by the trace, taking the trace on the other side and dividing by the dimension of the other side, of the Hilbert space on the other side. Okay, so for finite dimensional vector spaces, it's obviously easy to write down Hamiltonians on the left and the right. So in the case of a theory with a lattice regulator, it's just exactly this. So with these projections, we would recover the original operators on each factor if the Hilbert spaces were finite dimensional. But they're not. So the Hilbert spaces are infinite dimensional, and we have to do a little bit more work, but not too much more work. So we could try to ultraviolet regulate the theory so that the Hilbert spaces would be finite dimensional and the trace would be always well defined. But as I say, I don't really want to do that. I mean, we would be done, of course, but you might say, and I think I would agree, that that would be tantamount to assuming the existence of a lattice regulator. It's practically the same thing. Right, so I would call it cheating a bit. So assuming the existence of a lattice regulator or of a regulator rendering these Hilbert spaces finite, it's more or less assuming to, equivalent to assuming a lattice regulator. And we don't want to do that. We want to prove the more general statement. So instead, we're going to regulate the trace. So we're going to make it, so the real problem is that the full Hamiltonian isn't trace class on either side with either partial trace. But so instead, we're going to regulate the trace using the intrinsic data of the CFT itself, namely the renormalized conformal Hamiltonian, which we can use to define a heat kernel, which is trace class, and an operator with finite trace in each factor that approximates the Hamiltonian and is local to all orders in a high temperature expansion. So, in other words, we define a regulated single-sided Hamiltonian this way. So H on side A is defined as negative 1 over epsilon times the log of the partial trace on the other side of the heat kernel at temperature 1 over epsilon. That's the definition. Questions on that? So this regulated Hamiltonian has finite trace in the full Hilbert space, and thus finite trace in each factor individually. It's also a local operator, which is to say, you know, the exponential of an integral of a local density that approaches the density of the full Hamiltonian as epsilon is taken to zero for any point away from the entangling surface. Okay. So, I mean, the slogan is that in general, the modular Hamiltonian is not really a Hamiltonian. In fact, in general, the modular Hamiltonian isn't even local. But in general, the high temperature modular Hamiltonian, the modular Hamiltonian of the high temperature thermal ensemble is local on scales longer than the inverse temperature. This is easy to see in many ways, one of which is by taking commutators with local operators. So it commutes with local operators at a point to other local operators at the same point up to corrections that vanish exponentially as epsilon goes to zero. In fact, I should have said commutes with the same commutation relations as the time Hamiltonian on the full space. So here the one-sided traces are exponentials of the von Neumann entropies of the reduced density matrices of the thermal ensemble at temperature 1 over epsilon. They play the role of the effective dimension of the Hilbert space, accessible with energy 1 over epsilon. So for any point in the interior of A or B, the regulated one-sided Hamiltonian is equal to the unregulated Hamiltonian, plus corrections with vanish exponentially with epsilon as epsilon goes to 0, and are local to all orders in epsilon. Questions so far? So in other words, this procedure generalizes the procedure of deriving a one-sided Hamiltonian from a two-sided Hamiltonian in the case of a lattice system, but it does not depend at all on the existence of a lattice regulator. It is a fully general recipe. Given data defining a local tensor factorization, a recipe for deriving a boundary condition from the data of a tensor factorization. So the boundary is different. At the boundary, or the entangling surface, operators can appear with negative powers of epsilon. And so in particular, the Hamiltonian, the boundary Hamiltonian, will contain a boundary cosmological constant, scaling as epsilon to the minus 1. But in general, other relevant boundary operators can also appear with coefficients scaling as epsilon to the big delta minus 1, where delta is the dimension of the boundary operator. We don't know what the boundary condition is, but we know that there is one. We have derived a Hamiltonian on side A, which implements the same operator equations of motion as the original Hamiltonian, but it only propagates information within side A, because we have traced out all degrees of freedom on side B. We don't know anything about this boundary condition or the operator or the boundary Hamiltonian, but we can say general things based on general properties of boundary renormalization group flow. So we can't say much in detail, but again, we can appeal to the Friedan-Konechny hypothesis. So scaling epsilon to zero amounts to a boundary renormalization group flow in a CFT, and so it must go to a conformal point if indeed the G function is bounded below, as it's conjectured to be. So again, under the Friedan-Konechny hypothesis, which by the way is proved in various individual conformal field theories, using things like open-closed modular bootstrap, for instance, under the Friedan-Konechny hypothesis, we recover a conformal field theory with conformal boundary condition as we take epsilon to zero, simply by following the boundary renormalization group flow. Yes?
Sorry, I missed, you started with two subsystems, A and B.
Yes.
And I mean, you worked fast. How
boundary appear? So we traced out all the degrees of freedom on side B.
Right.
And we have a local Hamiltonian which implements the same operator equations of motion as the full Hamiltonian on side A.
Okay.
So we have a conformal field theory on a bounded region.
Yeah, but I mean, if you isolate yourself a subsystem and trace over the
yes.
The whatever is outside.
Yes.
Then boundary conditions which you are imposing this way are not going to be local boundary conditions.
Yes, it will. Yes, it will. Because we've defined our Hamiltonian in a local way. We defined our Hamiltonian in a way such that it is guaranteed to respect locality. So, I did go too fast, perhaps, but I'll write it right here. Okay. So, Hamiltonian side A, fine, guys. Limit, the high temperature limit
yes.
of negative 1 over epsilon, trace on side B. Exponential of negative epsilon h full. Right. So it's easier to see when one exponentiates both sides. So e to the minus epsilon h a is just trace on side b
e to the e to the minus epsilon h. The epsilon goes to zero limit. Okay, so it's easy to see that the that conjugating a local operator by on side A by this gives the same local equations of motion for
the. I'm not worrying about the locality of the bulk part.
Yes.
Worrying about locality of the bulk.
Good. Okay. So this isn't in the slides, but I'll let me say something about that. So there is an important condition. So I think. Yes.
Suppose we are sitting in this room.
Yes.
And we trace over the outside of this room.
Yes. At temperature,
it's not going to look like the boundary condition because I mean we will have neutrinos coming in.
No. High temperature thermal ensemble. High temperature thermal ensemble.
I'm not following you. I'm sorry.
Yeah, sorry. So one has to take the trace in a particular pure or mixed state.
I thought you were just taking trace over the whole Hilbert space of yours.
I'm defining a Hamiltonian by taking the trace in a particular mixed state of the full system.
Okay.
That mixed state is the high temperature thermal ensemble. So we're defining a Hamiltonian that way, and so
this is good. Well and good. I mean, let me say one last thing.
I think perhaps it'll be clear. So this statement, so one has a Euclidean transfer matrix.
Okay, I think I can imagine doing similar transformation to operator, but I'm worrying about very physical things. Yes. So to me, boundary looks like this. Like, so if I throw the ball, bounce back. Your boundary would absorb the ball, which would then flow off light in the orbit of Pluto. No, your ball does not bounce back. Your ball can only bounce back one thermal wavelength. Well, if I have a boundary of normal time,
yes,
one way or another, everything will bounce back.
Oh yes, so the process you're talking about.
Was the original theory conformal?
Yeah, the original theory is conformal. Yeah, that's right. But so the bulk Hamiltonian flows to the same bulk Hamiltonian.
Basically, invariant, epsilon just drops out of the expression.
Yeah, eventually, in the far infrared.
No. I'm saying the definition of HA, right?
Yes.
Epsilon is the length theory.
Yes.
So it drops out.
So that's not quite right. So even in conformal theories, the definition of the tensor factorization can be UV sensitive. So there is no canonical definition of a tensor factorization in a continuum field theory. So this point has been made by actually many people before us, but it's also true. So no. So the UV sensitivity comes in through the data of the tensor factorization itself. And even in perfectly well-behaved theories with no anomaly, there is an issue to do with uniqueness of that tensor factorization data. That tensor factorization data is highly non-unique. It's been shown that if you define it by a lattice construction, it depends on the nature of the lattice regulator. It depends on many, many things, but there is no canonical definition of the UV of the tensor factorization. So the illusion of canonicity of the data of the tensor factorization has to do with the existence of the Cardi-Calabrese formalism, but that formalism is in fact UV sensitive in various ways.
Still way more comfortable if you define the Hamiltonian in a segment rather than half space.
Yeah, I mean this can all be done in the segment if you like. That's fine.
Yeah, because even on the line, even without doing it, even on the line, right, I would say, okay, I can recover that Hamiltonian by doing the index of e to the minus epsilon h and send epsilon to zero. But it's confusing, right, because you're getting a strip of thickness epsilon, but whatever calculation it does is equivalent to a strip of thickness one, so there is no epsilon to zero limit, I can have a conformal theory.
That's right.
So
I agree with you.
You introduce next Alex scaling that formula to make sense.
Yeah, I just did it on the half line instead of the interval just to spare writing a lot of things. I agree with you, it is better to do it on the interval. Yes.
Do it on intervals.
That's right. Right, absolutely. I mean, so there are certain things which are a little bit hand-wavy on the line, which are not hand-wavy at all on the interval. Yeah. Yes.
Somehow the idea of replacing the universe outside this room by a boundary condition sounds, a bit counterintuitive to me. Despite the fact that, it looks like we are replacing the outside universe by liquid displaced these days all the time.
Yes.
But,
the amazing thing about theoretical physics is that it sometimes tells us things we didn't already expect, especially when the anomaly.
I mean, so, even if you said that the universe outside of the window is very, very hot.
Yes.
Wouldn't the window be hot?
Sure.
Wouldn't there be a problem?
Yes. No. No, because once we have this transfer matrix, so suppose now we want to describe physics on the interval at temperature beta. So suppose we want to describe physics on the interval at some fixed temperature beta. So we want to calculate the partition function on the interval of length L or something. So now we take trace.
I mean, I wanted to put that along with the substantial definition.
Hold on, I'm about to tell you why you don't have to worry about anything.
I worry about nothing.
Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. So the following partition function, the following partition function describes the thermal partition function on the interval A at inverse temperature beta. Just any inverse temperature beta you like. So this partition function, call it Z. This partition function is defined as trace on side A of exp minus beta H sub A, which is equal to trace on side A of exp minus beta over epsilon trace on side B e to the minus epsilon h. Which, if you like, you can represent more simply as the limit as n goes to infinity with n epsilon held fixed at beta of trace A trace of B of minus epsilon H raised to the nth power. Oh, one second. Yes. Before I get to your question, I just want to make one comment, which I think is particularly important. The reason is, from the point of view of conformal theory, which is completely straightforward, almost trivial, the reason that this point is not appreciated, I think, in the sort of old school quantum gravity community, is that this is a case in which conformal field theory actually tells you something you might not have wanted to know in the first place, rather than merely reinforcing one's prejudices about how gravity behaves in the bulk. This is an almost completely transparent form of knowledge on gravity. But it is, in fact, true. Yes, so question.
I'm sorry, it's a last question. I can't interrupt you if you want. But let me ask just one yes or no question.
Yes.
Suppose you have a finite system.
Yes.
Like a system of a circle.
Yes.
In your system of terms, yes. Ground state of this system,
yes.
Is a legitimate boundary state or not?
No. In no system is the vacuum ever a boundary. So the vacuum. The boundary state is described by functions. So the first is L sub n minus L tilde sub negative n on B equals zero for all n. And the second is that trace.
Yes, this one comes from which idea?
This comes This comes from the fact that this just comes from the combination of unitarity and energy conservation in the integrals.
It's in particular a statement of locality.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Sorry, I'm assuming locality everywhere. Absolutely. Whenever I say conformal field theory, I always mean local conformal field theory.
There is two distinct things, local conformal field theory, which means locality in the bulk,
yes.
And also local or non-local boundary.
That's right.
To me, if you just confine your space, yourself to the interior of this room and try to replace the outside universe by boundary conditions, it's going to be higher than normal.
But remember, we didn't try to replace the outside by boundary condition. We derived the existence of a boundary condition. But let me say a bit more about it. In fact, there was a condition which I didn't mention, but it is important to what you're talking about. So the technical condition characterizing the locality of the tensor factorization is as follows. So this is technical, it's a little bit boring. So the tensor factorization is described by a map from the unfactorized Hilbert space to factorized Hilbert space. And there is no canonical map because of ultraviolet singularities, but there are always, in theories with good factorizations, there is always a resolved tensor factorization. So let's call it a tensor factorization that can be performed over a time and distance scale epsilon. So the condition of locality is as follows. M dagger M equals a product of almost local operators at the entanglement. So for instance, we will check that the tensor factorization does not satisfy this property. The Holsey will check definition is a sum of products of local operators, gives you a sum of products of local operators at the entanglement. But the condition of this is that if you take the system and then map to the factorized space for just an instant, the length epsilon, and then map back, the effect is just inserting local operators at the boundary in an uncorrelated way, in a factorized way. So that's the technical assumption we're using to define the notion of a local tensor factorization. So in particular, Holsey-Wilczek definition does not satisfy that property, but this property is implicitly assumed in discussions of boundary renormalization of entanglement entropy of the entanglement surfaces. So you can't actually do without this definition. Holsey-Wilczek is not a just as good definition, you know, from that.
I need to just transition to ending the talk and maybe a less formal discussion.
Yeah, that's fine. So that was the main point has been made. So let me skip to the conclusions. Okay, so we've examined the self-consistency of the concept of entanglement in continuum field theory. In the gravitationally anomalous case in two dimensions,
We've seen that the concept is simply ill-defined because the Hilbert space does not tensor factorize so as to respect locality. And I didn't get to it, but I'm happy to discuss the fact that this is really an infrared, a long-distance obstruction to factorization. It is not a short-distance artifact. As a byproduct, we've proved a generalized version of the Nielsen-Nemea theorem, establishing a no-go principle for lattice regulators for gravitationally anomalous CFT. The obstruction to factorization can be thought of as a quantum information theoretic refinement of the Nielsen-Nemea theorem, establishing a no-go theorem for tensor factorizations, even in a generalized sense. Boundary conditions play an important role. We've needed to assume Friedan and Konechny's hypothesis, but we haven't needed to assume the existence of a boundary condition. It's derived, not assumed. The obstruction to factorization is physical, not merely formal. So one consequence is that states with a vanishing correlation between regions do not exist at all in gravitationally anomalous CFT. So you can ask, for instance, if I put sufficiently much energy into the system, can I build a pure state with correlations between side A and side B, which are suppressed, uniformly suppressed, as we raise the energy? And the answer is no. In non-anomalous theories, one can build such states quite easily, usually. In gravitationally anomalous theories, one can never build them. Thank you.